starfish. A very brave starfish who loves to travel the world on the salty seas.
But what about if a shark eats his arms?
They just grow them back again.
Really?
Really.
Warm your hands up first.
We are going to have so much fun.
Tom, look at me. Can you hear me? Stay awake, Tom. Stay awake.
I don't understand.
There will have to be intervention.
That's not my daddy.
I'll get the new you home. Get back on track. And he's still your same daddy, even though he looks a little bit different.
I can't kiss him goodnight. I can't hold their hand.
Tom.
What?
You only see how this thing affects you. You won't see how it's hurting everybody else. You just suck all the air out of every room you're in. I'll never stop loving you, Tom. I'll never stop believing in you.
His illness came out of nowhere. He was Mr. Normal. Help us fight the battles we are going to have to face, and you will have the undying gratitude of a small but very determined family.
Daddy!
Grey. Some of you may be familiar with the Starfish film. This was around 15 years ago, and Tom had what he thought was gastroenteritis. Actually, what had happened was he'd been to see his dentist a few days before and had sustained a nick to his gum, which then became infected, hence his battle with sepsis. Tom lost all four limbs and most of his face, and they lost their home, they lost their business, they lost everything, and Nicola gave birth to their second child while Tom was in intensive care because he was in there for 6 months. And this journey started for me with this family, Jeremy and Karen Abbotts and their two children, Thomas and Emily. This was around 12 years ago now. Jeremy was a fit, healthy 30-year-old. He had no past medical history, and he went into hospital for a routine vasectomy, had an unremarkable recovery for the first 24 hours, and then after 24 hours just started to feel unwell, flu-like symptoms. Karen told him to take some paracetamol, take some fluids, go back to bed, which he did. And he just got progressively worse until he lost his speech. He became really slurred with his speech. And Karen said it was almost as if he was drunk. She couldn't get any sense out of him. They'd been to the walk-in centre, they'd been to the GP, they'd been sent home on both occasions and told that it was a virus with no follow-up. And on the Friday evening, Karen said he started to develop diarrhoea and vomiting and was just deteriorating really quickly in front of her eyes. And he came into our A&E department, and on the Monday morning, I walked into intensive care and there were just a pair of black feet sticking out of the end of the bed. And that afternoon, we had to tell Karen that Jeremy was never going to come home again. And so that's where it all started for us, because when we looked back in the medical notes, we saw really, really classic signs that we should have picked up. We should have picked them up as soon as he came into A&E. And we didn't. We didn't pick those signs up. We wandered around in the same case as Tom, when Tom talks about his story. You know, people pulled back the curtain in A&E, saw somebody lying in bed, didn't know what to do with him, and pulled the curtain again. And this was a continual thing because nobody knew what to do with him. And so when we looked through the work and what we'd seen, that's how we developed the sepsis 6. So that was developed by us many years ago now in a very small back room, really, at the back of intensive care. But we knew that just from putting those things in place, that it was going to make a significant difference. Quite ironic when I'm standing in the middle of a football stadium. But this is a Premiership football stadium, just to mention that, although we're not very good anymore. But it's just to show that a reasonably good Premiership football stadium on a good day holds around 44,000 people. And we know from the work that we've done that's the amount of people that die from breast cancer every year. That's the amount of people that die from bowel cancer. But we lose a whole football stadium every single year from people that die of sepsis. It affects 250,000 people and 44,000 of those will die. 10,000 children are affected and 1,000 of those children will die. So these are huge figures. This is not to belittle any other illness, but when we think about the treatments that we have for other illnesses, we think about the targets we have. So as an ED nurse, I know that if a patient comes in that's got an MI, I have a target to meet. If a patient comes in that's had a stroke, I have a target to meet. At the moment, for patients that come in with sepsis, there is no target. We know that if we give treatment within the first hour, their chances of mortality are much improved, but there isn't actually anything physically to say to me that I have to do something within that time. Interestingly, this week, on Monday, I did my clinical shift and I treated 6 patients with sepsis just in that one day, just through my resus department. It's great that we're recognising these patients more and more, but the knowledge isn't quite out there yet. So for a lot of our junior doctors and our junior nurses, they're not working in the same way that we'd like them to, and the recognition of these patients can be quite difficult. So whilst it costs around £90 to save a life, and we've worked that out from the cost of fluids and antibiotics and some nursing time, we know that if we don't treat these patients quickly, it's the tip of the iceberg, really, because any patient that goes to intensive care, then the bills become really, really huge. So the best thing for us to do is to not let that happen. Now, we're never going to cure sepsis and we're never going to stop some patients going to intensive care. But what we can do is we can get those first treatments in within the first hour in a hope that things are going to improve. I've treated hundreds and hundreds of patients, and some of those patients I've treated probably within a kind of record time of around 40 minutes and got them into an intensive care unit. I was on one Saturday and Ron Daniels was the intensivist. I was the ED nurse in resus. Couldn't really have had a better kind of combination at that time. And a chap came in who'd been playing golf that morning and we had him admitted into ITU within 40 minutes of admission, and he died 3 hours later. So whatever we do, we're never ever going to cure sepsis, but what we need to start thinking about is how we get good practice instilled in people. How do we measure when patients come in? What do we use? What screening tools should we be using? Do we use them everywhere? Do we use the right ones? There are lots of places out there, lots of hospitals that are still not using screening tools. There are lots of different screening tools out there. The ones that we use are from the NICE guidelines, but there are lots of adaptable ones that are out there. So the National Confidential Inquiry into Patient Outcome and Death in 2015 looked at a whole host of areas, and as Julie said, and I know Julie very well, she does an awful lot of work for the charity. As Julie said, it wasn't just one single person, it was a whole host of people that didn't actually know what to do with Julie, didn't actually know what was going on. I think that was brought out in the NCPOD report. So one of the things that it talked about was GPs having difficulty carrying antimicrobials. And when I talk to a whole room of GPs, you know, it's a very difficult situation, because the amount of patients that actually go to a GP that are in septic shock and that would need IV antibiotics at that stage are fairly small, really. But it's about education. It's about having the ability as practice nurses to be able to cannulate, to be able to give IV antibiotics. Is that actually viable? Is it actually cost effective? A third of GPs that were reviewed found that none of the 4 basic vital signs had been measured in those cases. But interestingly enough, when they came into the emergency department, we saw that a full set of vital signs was only taken in 40% of cases. Now, I find that quite astonishing that number was so low. But I think one of the problems that we have is that we're under so much pressure and we see so many patients, particularly now. I mean, we're in the winter. I don't think we've ever come out of the winter crisis, to be fair, but we're back in it again. And it's the pressure on everybody to get patients through the system. You know, are we actually recording observations properly? Do we have enough equipment out there? You know, what is it that we're missing? Why are we failing to do this? Because one of the things for me as a patient myself, back in September of last year, a poor student nurse used to come in to me every 4 hours to do my ops, and my respiratory rate was 16 for the whole 3 days that I was in there. Never ever faltered, because she would give me a little bit of eye contact and then leave the room, because it takes time. Everything takes time to do. But the problem is that we miss these things. And one of the big problems for me, particularly with observations when I talk to staff, is they don't always recognise when things are abnormal. So we know when things are right, but we don't always know when they're abnormal. And one of the big things is temperature. So for me, as a critical care outreach nurse, if somebody calls me and says they've got a patient who's scoring 4 or more on their Muse, and I ask them what their temperature is, and they'll say, oh, their temperature's normal. And I'll say, yeah, but what is it? Oh, no, I'm not worried about that, it's normal. Yes, but what is it? It's 35.1. That isn't normal. And it's about having that recognition and having that understanding of how these things fit together and exactly what we should be looking for. There's a lot of people out in the media that have had sepsis. More and more are kind of being talked about now. And a lot of people return to a fairly normal way of life. But for an awful lot of people, Julie, for example, their life will never be the same again. Tom and Nick Ray, that's a very extreme case, but their life will never, ever be the same again. And what have we got there out there for people? We haven't got anything. So for patients that have had cancer or have had an MI or have had a stroke, there are groups, support groups out there afterwards for these people to go to talk about what they've been through, to talk about how they're going to get back to work. With sepsis at the moment, we have some very small pocketed groups, of which Julie leads on one, throughout the UK. But these are not national groups. We don't have anything. So people meet at these support groups and they have no idea why after 18 months they're still unable to return to work. Sepsis isn't classed as a critical illness. So there is nothing, there is no support out there if you can't return to work. People lose the skin off their hands and off their feet. They lose their hair and nobody understands why. We don't know why. We don't know what the reasons are at the moment. But we need to have that support out there. So in our very small office in Birmingham, we have a group of 4 people that are our support service. And they are inundated with calls every single day from people that have had sepsis and don't know how to deal with it. The first time they might have heard about sepsis is when they leave hospital. It might be on their discharge letter. For some relatives, the first time they might know about sepsis is on a death certificate. So we have to get that message out there. We have to let people understand what sepsis is, why we get it, what happens when we get it, and what the post-traumatic period is afterwards. Some people do return to work, but for an awful lot of people, it's a very, very long process. So let's just talk briefly about antibiotics. There's an awful lot of talk about antibiotics at the moment, and when I talk to GPs, you can imagine the response I get about talking about antibiotics. But I'm talking about antibiotics in patients that need them. So one of the biggest problems we have is delivery of those antibiotics, because we know from the research that we did back in 2007 that if we give antibiotics, fluids and oxygen within the first hour, chances of survival are much, much better. Now, way back then, we had a very small range of antibiotics, and anything else you needed, you would have to get from pharmacy. Times have changed now, and most areas cover a broad spectrum of antibiotics, so there isn't that delay. But there can be a delay in prescribing, there can be a delay if the patient isn't cannulated, particularly at times like this where we pulled, senior nurses are pulled from education to go back onto the shop floor, so then your education suffers, so then your nurses are not being trained in cannulation and IV drug administration. It's a whole host of problems, but what we need to think about is prioritising these patients, because these patients need their antibiotics very quickly once we've diagnosed sepsis. And interestingly, the other day there was a very junior doctor looking after a patient, and this patient was clearly had a rip-roaring chest infection, but the doctor was adamant that they just wanted to wait for the chest x-ray to come back before we administered the antibiotics, and that tipped us over that hour time zone, really. So it's about everything coming together. It's about getting that recognition in really, really early and starting to treat the patient as soon as you possibly can. So if somebody like this presented to any clinicians in the room, no doubt you would be concerned, as I would be. But these aren't the patients that we necessarily miss, because these patients are barn door. You see that as soon as they walk in. It's patients like William. Many of you will have heard of William. You may well have heard Melissa speak about William. Interestingly, it's exactly 4 years today since William died. William was seen on 11 separate occasions by 11 different health professionals. There was nothing in his notes that matched up. Nobody looked at what the previous person had written because everything was in a different place. And Melissa said time and time and time again that William was not well. William had bilateral pneumonias and had around a litre of pus at post-mortem in his chest. Melissa will say that regardless of what happened that day, she understands that nobody set out to cause William any harm. But what she will never understand is how so many people missed what was going on with William. Because he was so sick, he became so sick so quickly, and again, he was sent home and he died in his sleep. And it's people like William that we need to really, really fight for, because these people are unwell. We need to listen to relatives. We need to listen to what people are saying to us. Just because we're health professionals doesn't mean that we know all the answers all of the time, and we should take on board what people are saying to us. If they're telling us that their child or their relative isn't well, then we need to be taking account for that. I've had cases in the past where the patient doesn't, the kind of figures don't really match at the first presentation, but actually they're saying to me, you know, I just feel like I'm going to die. Had that with a very recent 23-year-old who came in, and the only thing that was triggering was her respiratory rate. She'd actually got toxic shock syndrome and became incredibly sick incredibly quickly. And she was saying to me, I'm going to die. Please help me. I'm going to die. Now, for a very junior nurse, that might not have had any kind of thought process to go through it. But just because she was saying it to me, and just because there was something, just something inside that told me that she wasn't well, thank God we gave her the right treatment and she made a full recovery. So this is an example of some of the screening tools. Can you see it better on that one? Sorry, the top is cut off. So this is a community nursing screening tool, but we have them for emergency departments, acute medical units, community, paediatrics, obstetrics and midwifery, a whole host of them, and they're all available. You can see them on the UK Sepsis Trust website. And really, it's just about putting that into practice. So for a patient that comes into the emergency department, the first thing that I would say is that you score your patient on their news or their muse or whatever you're using at that time. And if they're triggering or you think there are suspected signs of infection, that you get a screening tool out and you do that tick box exercise. It takes a few seconds, but it will give you a really clear indication of whether your patient has sepsis or not. It's really easy to fill in, and it takes literally minutes. And there are some places that are now adopting the approach that these screening tools have to go in every single patient's set of notes. Whether they're used or not, they have to be there so that they're a kind of reminder that it needs to be used. Because I could go into my own hospital, walk around half the wards, ask them where the screening tools are, and I'd probably get a very blank look on a lot of people's faces. Or they're in the back of a drawer somewhere, or they're version 3 and we're on version 7 by now. So we know that there's a lot of work to be done, but we need to get those screening tools used because it makes a huge difference to the way we treat our patients. This is an example of an inpatient screening tool. So the only difference is that the community screening tool is asking you, does your patient look unwell? Because you've got very limited ability to do full sets of observations, etc., at that time. This is asking you about their new score. That's the only difference, really. It's asking you about whether or not the patient's relatives are concerned about them. Are they concerned? Do they think this is normal for them? And then it just moves on to talk about infection. Are there any red flags there? Are there any amber flags there? You know, just really to start people's minds thinking about what might possibly be going on. And then on the flip side of the screening tool is the Sepsis 6. And you can see the Sepsis 6 talks about administering oxygen. It talks about blood cultures, talks about giving antibiotics, giving fluids, checking serial lactates and measuring urine output. Now with blood cultures, again, going back to the time frame that you've got, we always used to say that blood culture should always be taken before we gave IV antibiotics. But actually, if it's going to take more than an hour to get some blood cultures, or you're going to be coming up to that time frame, then what we suggest is that the antibiotics are given if you can't get blood cultures, because what we don't want to do is delay things any further than they already are. With serial lactates, in a hospital, that's very easy to do. Outside of a hospital, it's not that easy to do. And unless lactate analyses are carried elsewhere, then it becomes quite difficult. But interestingly, a patient that came into me the other day, when the patient came in, the first thing I did was a blood gas and the lactate was 6. And the paramedic said to me, oh, that would have been really helpful if we'd had that lactate analyser on board the back of our ambulance. And I'm kind of in two minds about that, because what are you actually going to do about that in the back of an ambulance? What I'd rather is that you spend your time getting the patient into an emergency department where we can treat them very quickly, than do all that type of thing on the side of the road, because it just delays time. We need to get the patients through the system. And urine output, as a nurse, I'm allowed to say that we are notoriously bad at measuring urine output. We shouldn't be catheterising every patient that comes through the doors, but we should at least be recognising urine output as one of the first assessments that we do. And in a lot of times, we miss that. So I'm very sort of clued up to asking patients, when was the last time they passed urine? Because in a patient that's delirious because they've got sepsis, they might not even be able to tell you that. Some patients might say, just before I came in. Some might say, actually, it was yesterday. It's really important that we've got that information before we start the treatment of our patients. So the whole of this needs to be completed properly. And the time element on it isn't a catch-out thing. The time thing is so that when we look back, if we look back at notes retrospectively, that we can see when that was given, when the delivery took place. This is the study that we did. It was very small. There were 567 patients in the study. You can see from this that 347 of them didn't receive the sepsis 6 and their mortality was 44%, but 220 of them did and their mortality was 20%, so it was less than half. It was really, really simple. I conducted the study and I am no genius, I can assure you. But it just goes to show that actually, if we got the treatment in quickly, that mortality was more than half. And this is just a timeline from Nottingham University Hospital. They did some work back in 2005. And you can see from that that they were seen by a doctor and blood cultures were taken pretty much as soon as the patient presented. But there were no antibiotics given till about 2.5 hours down, further down the system. And they weren't seen by a senior until much, much later. So their time to critical care was much later than we would have probably liked. When they repeated the study in 2009, there wasn't a huge amount of change apart from some radiology input at 2.5 hours and seen by a senior doctor slightly ahead of time. But again, it was 2.5 hours before any antibiotics were administered. But then in 2012, things changed massively and they were seen by a senior, blood cultures, antibiotics and radiology all within the first hour of presentation. So there were some huge, huge changes made in a reasonably short space of time. And that's it, really. It's about getting that message across. It's about empowering people to ask the question. You know, we should empower our patients. They should be able to ask, is this sepsis? I start to hear it a little bit more than I ever used to. And also with relatives. And I think one of the most important things is there is going to come a time when the public awareness campaign kicks off, possibly towards the start of next year, that questions are going to be asked and we are going to be accountable for the fact that our patients are not receiving treatment as soon as they should be, and that will become a reality. So at the moment, no questions are really asked unless it's direct, but these sorts of things are going to start to come through. So what are we doing about it? Don't shoot me for that slide, anybody in the room. But, you know, the time has come. It is a recognised condition. And we need to be putting the same effort into it than we have done for previous illnesses such as meningitis, MRSA and C. diff. So we need to be starting to push that work forward. But we can't do that without any money. And that's one thing that he's not giving over at the moment, is any money. So we're doing this in really small batches, and we're doing it from an office in Birmingham where we have a staff of about 14, 15 people. And people like me who go out on the road at silly o'clock this morning from freezing Birmingham. I know we don't get bad weather down south, but I can assure you I'm a northern girl and that's been quite bad for us, really, to fabulous rain when I arrived here. But, you know, that's what my passion is to get out there and it's to tell people what we should be doing and how we should be doing it. And interestingly, I don't know whether you will have seen any of these locally. I don't think you will at the moment, but I got really excited when I went to work the other day because there was one parked at the front of my emergency department. They're all over Cornwall and Devon, thanks to Melissa Mead, because she's campaigned tirelessly for this to be on the back of ambulances, but they are starting to come through. And I think there are going to be something like another 74 new ambulances in the system throughout England and Wales next year, and they will all carry this for around 5 years. So that's a massive achievement for us to have really pushed that forward. You'll see it on the back of first response cars, and you'll also start to see it on pharmacy bags. So when patients are discharged with TTOs, you'll start to see this on the back of there. Interestingly, Birmingham Dental Hospital, I've done some work with them, and they now send all of their patients home because they're all day case patients, but have gone in with some fairly nasty abscesses and tooth extractions and God knows what else. They send them all home now with a Sepsis 6 card to tell them to look for the signs and symptoms if they suspect anything after they've left, if they start to feel unwell. And the same with NHS 111 on the back of William's death. NHS 111 now send a text message with the signs and symptoms on to anybody that's phoned that potentially might have some sort of infection. So we are getting there. It's very, very small timeframes and very small amounts of work, but we are really, really pushing for this to come through. So we know that it's a serious condition, and it can be self-limiting infections such as flu, gastroenteritis or a chest infection. We're looking for slurred speech. We're looking for extreme shivering or muscle pain, passing no urine in a day, severe breathlessness. And like I said to you, that feeling that I just feel like I'm going to die. And I have heard that in quite a few cases. And in really late stages, then you'll see mottled and discoloured skin. And just very quickly, because I think I'm slightly over time, I just want to talk to you about Tilly. Tilly is a twin, but she's also one of four girls, and she was the last of the girls to contract chickenpox. And Tilly's mum said she just went off her food. She was just very, very lethargic and just not like the other girls, and took her to the GP, and he just said it was worse than the other three cases, and that she would get over it. And on Easter bank holiday weekend, her dad said enough is enough, took her into their local A&E department and refused to leave until a paediatric consultant saw Tilly. And 40 minutes later, she was ventilated in PICU. And Melissa will always ask the question, why did that not happen with William? What was the difference? You know, I said the same thing. I knew my child wasn't well, but nobody listened to me. Luckily for Tilly, she made a full recovery. And, you know, she lives a relatively normal life now. But for William, it was sadly a very different story. For Jason Watkins, who many of you may know, his daughter Maud was 2.5. Same scenario. She had a chest infection and they saw doctors on New Year's Eve. She was given steroids and antibiotics to go home with, and she was found dead by her sister in the cot the next morning. You know, these are real life stories. This isn't, you know, this is a massive reality that we really need to start getting right. So we've got our clinical toolkits. All of this information and all the screening tools are available on the UK Sepsis Trust website. And cards, I think things have been sent. Yeah, I'm getting a nod from the back there. So there are leaflets, there are cards, etc., that you're very welcome to have today. And the recommendations that we've had are that all hospitals should have a formal protocol. We should be able to facilitate the transition from primary to secondary care. So the information that we get in primary care settings should be transferred to secondary care so that we know what's going on with our patients. If they've been on antibiotics for a week, we know that when they come through to an emergency department. We need to look at source control, early identification, guidelines and tools. We should be 100% compliant with our care bundles, and antimicrobial policy should be in place, and we should have senior microbiology input 24/7. You'll see these branded around. These are in our GP surgeries. They're in most of our pharmacies now. Boots have just come on board. So again, it's a massive step forward for us, but you will start to see these things around. And together, if we get this right, we know we can save around 14,000 lives every year. And that's me done. Thank you very much.